Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of the White Horse Inn. Ken Jones and I are in Philadelphia this week for the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology with Reverend Don Kistler. Don Kistler, as many of you know, is in charge of Soli Deo Gloria, a publishing company that puts out some terrific literature, and it specializes in putting out reprinting Puritan literature. And so in this program, we wanted to take a look at Puritanism. And that's often an area that many people haven't explored. Even a lot of Reformed people haven't taken a close look at the Puritans. They have some idea of the Puritans, some stereotypes of the Puritans. What I hope that we could accomplish in this program is to get a better look at them with someone who is out there culling through their materials, republishing it, and bringing it back into the bloodstream. Don, it's great to have you on.
Thank you. Good to be here.
J.I. Packer wrote that book, at least the English title was Among God's Giants. Mm-hmm. And in that book, Packer made the point that it's really difficult to make the contrast too great between the pygmy spirituality, as he called it, of our day, and the deep running waters of Puritan spirituality. Do you think he's right on that?
There's just no comparison, and I think the idea of being a pygmy in our day is very, very good. It's kind of how I feel when I go and visit Oxford and Cambridge. I think of the giants who once walked those streets and the pygmies who are there now. We are so far removed from that depth of spirituality as to almost be undiscernible.
How, if at all, did the content of Puritan preaching determine much of their outlook on life in general and on their task as Christians?
Well, they were very bibliocentered, and believing, as most of them did, in the regulative principle, not only of worship but of life, that there had to be a scriptural warrant for what we do. But their battle cry was holiness unto the Lord. So it was holiness not only in the pulpit, but holiness in the home, holiness on the job, and that every vocation was sacred because God had called a person to it. But our behavior, our conduct, our decisions were all to be because we were so immersed in Scripture as to make biblical choices.
Now, holiness unto the Lord, how would you distinguish that from, say, the holiness movement of the 19th century?
And that's a good question, because terms get changed, as we were just joking before we started here. That the holiness movement tends to be more of a Pentecostal, emotional movement, where these people, they were named Puritans because they wanted to be pure and they wanted a pure church. So the idea of holiness was really that of purity regulated by Scripture.
Okay, so didn't this in the history of it all mean that you couldn't have a lot of extra-biblical rules, which kind of shoots the stereotype of the Puritans out of the sky?
It's people look at them as being very strict, but then they believe that God was very clear in what he wanted. And where God had stated what he wanted, it was not up to us to sit loose in the chair and decided, well, that's really not the best idea. And so they were very faithful to the Scriptures. For example, you wouldn't find any Puritan churches that I'm aware of. I mean, I'm certainly somebody could find one, but where they celebrated Christmas, because there's no warrant in Scripture to celebrate the birth of Christ. And so if we were preaching on John 14:1 the week before Christmas, the next week we'd preach on John 14:2. And they might have private celebrations in their homes, but it wouldn't be part of their worship. And they just believed that the Scripture was sufficient to regulate all of life.
Because I think this is a big stereotype in a lot of people's minds. The whole idea of a puritanical piety. One thing that strikes me about the Puritans is that their passion for the regulative principle is precisely what drove them in the direction of saying no laws that God himself hasn't imposed. So it was actually an anti-legalistic movement in a lot of respects.
Very much so. This idea, as I mentioned in the seminar yesterday, and I think it was Beecher Stowe who said this, but my memory might fail me here, is that Puritanism is the burning sensation that somewhere, somebody might be having a good time.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the sour, dour, old Puritan idea. It just doesn't hold up. Now, as in any movement, there are extremes on both ends. But the Puritans enjoyed life to the max. I mean, they enjoyed wine at home. They had large families. Obviously, they weren't afraid of conjugal relations or any such thing as that. Even during the Westminster Assembly, some of the ones were chided who were sitting in the back because they spent all their time reading the newspaper. I mean, these were real human beings. And one of the reasons that I wrote my book on the Puritan Christopher Love was just to show that he and his wife were people with deep emotions, great love, great passion, and they were normal people just like the rest of us.
I think that's what gets lost in the stereotypes, that the people that the Puritans really did enjoy life. And then on the same token, I think the danger of the resurgence of Puritanism is that those who in our day are legalistic and moralistic tend to read their own concept of the spiritual life into the Puritans, and sometimes they gravitate towards those that did tend to be subjective or those that tended to be legalistic, and they label that for the whole movement.
You know, and I don't even know if we've gone in depth talking about this before, Don, but I did my doctoral research on the Puritan doctrine of assurance, and it took me into a lot of the Puritan literature, of course, and I was really struck I was a little skeptical at certain points, as I think people are when they first start reading the Puritans. Now, the Puritans were influential, and Ken, this is for you too, we were talking about influential in our movement into Reformation theology. They're a bridge for a lot of people, I think. But don't you think that the more I read them, especially on assurance, introspection, that there are some dangers, that you do have to be prepared for some differences of opinion, at least, on assurance.
Yes, and it's unfortunate that the amount of literature available, vast as it is at this point, is not necessarily representative of the Puritans. And one thing I think is very helpful to remember is that the Puritans wrote very few books. They preached a lot of sermons, which were transcribed and most often published posthumously. So it's not like so-and-so Puritan had in mind, I'm going to write this book on assurance and set the tone for all time. But he was preaching to his congregation, knowing their needs and what they needed to deal with in their own lives and such things. And then to take that and try to adapt it to the universal church is a little bit irresponsible. Mm. And so we need to be careful because, yes, Matthew Meade might preach this way to his congregation that can handle it. But if he had preached the same thing to Christopher Love's congregation, it might have done all kinds of damage. Mm. But then he wasn't doing that. Mm. And there are differences of opinion. I think ultimately they would all want to arrive at the same place. But Thomas Shepard, preaching on the parable of the 10 virgins, might be dealing with his congregation just as they need. But if he were to have done that in Thomas Watson's congregation, it might have been a disaster. And so not all that's out there is necessarily good for everybody to read.
You have to contextualize it.
You do.
One thing that you think about, too, is the relationship between people like Baxter and Owen.
Mm-hmm.
We often go back. A lot of the people who are getting excited about the Puritans again will go back and pick up the Reformed pastor and think, oh, Richard Baxter, he's one of the great Puritans. And they'll even hear, won't mention any names, but they'll hear respected Presbyterian Reformed people recommending Richard Baxter. And they don't often realize that Richard Baxter had some severe theological problems that many of the Puritans of his day picked up on. Isn't Puritanism a lot wider and broader than, look, here's a group of people who are like this, who think like this?
Well, historically, we've done that. And sometimes we do it because we don't know what else to call them.
Yeah.
I mean, with Jonathan Edwards, technically, Jonathan Edwards was not a Puritan. simply because the time that he lived was past the Puritan era. What else do you call Jonathan Edwards but a Puritan? We call him a New England Puritan. See? Now, Baxter had many friends among the Puritans. He was an Anglican out in Kidderminster, and there's a nice statue of him in front of his church there. But they wrote often against the Baxterian perversion of the doctrine of justification. Ian Murray has said that Baxter was largely responsible for John Wesley's errors in theology. And Baxter took a sanctification, then justification position. Now, we have reprinted Baxter's practical works, and there's nobody better on sanctification than Richard Baxter. But there's nobody worse to read on justification than Richard Baxter. Baxter's practical works have been reprinted, but his controversial and theological works have never been reprinted because they're so bad. And while the four volumes that we published make up everything that's ever been reprinted by Baxter, it's only 40% of what he wrote, and the rest is graciously and providentially hidden away.
Well, I guess I'd have a question then, because if you look at, because I know of contemporary preachers who are very similar to that. If you hear them in a discussion on the doctrine of justification, they're either off or some could be on. But then when you hear them talk about sanctification, it sounds like all of the exhortations that you get in Scripture. And my question is this, can we, especially in recommending a writer, can we on the one hand denounce his doctrine of justification and then support his doctrine of sanctification? Because eventually people might try to make a connection, and it will sound very much like the moralistic preaching that they get.
Some have. I'm not sure that we can make decisions based on the potential abuse of something.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, God works in spite of all of our errors. Our errors are no obstacle to God getting something across. All of us have errors in our theology. Now, you're talking about a very significant area of error at that point. And yet, as John MacArthur says, even a broken watch is right twice a day. Baxter was very solid in applying the Scripture to life. And how he missed that first part, I don't know. But on the other hand, there were some who were right on justification and wrong on sanctification.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a problem in our age, as you guys know, because people are not discerning. And we tend to buy everything that somebody says that we like.
Mm-hmm. And so some whatever he says.
Whatever he says, yeah. Across the board. Well, I like so-and-so on this, so I'll just believe everything he says. And so, you know, a man can write a book on justification, the next thing you know, he's writing a book on marriage, and I don't know what makes a man an expert on marriage just because he understands justification. But we say, well, I liked him on that, I like him on everything. Or people write in and say, you know, I don't agree with what you said in your conference, I believe what the Puritans said. Well, which one? On what?
Yeah, right.
And we just, right. Well, I like R.C. Sproul, so I like everything that R.C. Sproul says. Well, what do we do when people change?
Yeah.
And they come to a more mature position later in life or something like that, then we're stuck at that point.
Good point. In terms of preaching, one of the things that in poring over Puritan sermons I came away with was, you know, there is a lot of good stuff here in chunks. And there were times when I thought, I can't believe I'm actually doing this for academic credit, this is devotional, and get teary-eyed and so forth, just moving, and it moving because of its Christ-centered focus. And I remember times thinking, this is exactly the kind of preaching that we need. And then, even with the same preacher, or even in the same sermon, I felt like that was often taken away with what was given with the right is taken with the left. And part of that was the style. I want to ask you a question about Puritan preaching, because this is becoming an issue in Reformed circles. Do you preach redemptive historically, or do you preach in the Puritan style? I'm kind of critical of the Puritan style of preaching because I think it misses the redemptive historical flow of a text, where its placement in redemptive history, and its constant focus on redemption. How do you explain and defend the Puritan, you know, 65thly, you know, the points
sure.
of the sermon, where you sort of feel like their whole point is to exhaust the scriptures, and 30 sermons on one sentence seems to be a little bit too much.
There were different kinds of Puritans, and again, here's where we have a problem with saying, because this guy did this, Puritanism is wrong. Although it wasn't just one man doing it, obviously, as we mentioned in the seminar yesterday, we have William Googe preaching for 33 straight years on the book of Hebrews, and Joseph Carroll preaching for 25 years in the book of Job, Thomas Shepard preaching 6 months on the parable of the 10 virgins, and in fact, the extreme one that I've ever heard is the Puritan preacher who was preaching on Joseph's coat of many colors, taking a color a week, until the elders finally said, "Move it along, son. You're killing the people."
He knew what color the coat was?
That's a little more than we have in the text.
That's where we got the word eisegesis. Now, again, these were not expository sermons on verse 1 of Hebrews 1 and verse 2, but they were preaching the whole counsel of God, using that as a taking-off point. But they were very concerned, and they wanted to be different from the preachers of their day, who were what they called witty or eloquent preachers, who did a lot of Latin and Greek quotations, quotations from the fathers. And as Cotton Mather said, they wanted to show themselves scholars to their people rather than make their people scholars of Christ.
Instead of where today, it's the pastor wants to show that he is a comedian.
Yes, an entertainer, and if they like me, they'll like my Jesus. And again, I think we even have to put them in their own context. Those other types of sermons by men like Lancelot Andrews and John Donne and such things as that were highly informative, and yet people walked out scratching their heads saying, "So what?" And so, as you know, in church history, so many things are an overreaction to an abuse of something.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make sure that people know what to do with something. Now, we might look at that and say, maybe he should have broken that down into two or three sermons, or maybe that didn't need to be said at all. In fact, William Perkins, in his book, Art of Prophesying by Banner of Truth, said you don't want to overwhelm your people with application. But some did that. And again, it's interesting that so many of these men that we admire now were young in their ministry when they were doing some of these things, rather than older. And you and we all know the dangers and the errors that we made when we were youthful ministers, trying to tell everything we knew to impress people so that we could justify our existence. You know, well, you chose me over so-and-so, I better give you your money's worth. Or as I was saying, that sometimes men in a large church who are on a pastoral staff don't get to preach very often. And so when they finally get that chance, I'm going to tell them everything I learned since the last time I preached. Mm-hmm. And I think some of this can be looked at that way, where you have Thomas Shepard died at the age of 36. Christopher Love died at 33. And things like that, they didn't even have a chance to mature and become wise fathers in the faith, and yet the wisdom they showed at that age was remarkable. And so these may be typical of young preacher abuses rather than the movement as a whole.
Interesting. That's a very interesting read. Do Thomas Goodwin, I keep referring to, John Owen, Richard Sibbes, and others were concerned that the Puritanism of their generation, at that point in what's often called the spiritual brotherhood, that train of Puritan preachers and teachers, they were concerned that by their day, which is mid-17th century, a lot of Puritan reflection, pastoral practice, and preaching had taken the focus off of Christ and had put it on us and our performance. Do you find in your reading of the Puritans that there really is a mixed bag here, even on that point, that sometimes some of the clearest calls to recover Christ-centered preaching against moralistic preaching come from Puritans criticizing other Puritans?
There's something to that. But again, if we look at a book like The Almost Christian Discovered by Matthew Mead, which is one of our bestsellers, it was the Gospel According to Jesus 300 years before MacArthur wrote that book. And it basically is, Christians ought to obey Christ. Now, we shouldn't have a problem with that. If you love me, keep my commandments. And Mead goes through 26 things that a person who professes to be a Christian must do. But doing them doesn't prove he's a Christian. But not doing them would prove he wasn't. Now, just like Religious Affections by Edwards, some people are driven to the brink by stuff like that. On the other hand, Christopher Love writes a book, Mead's book seems to focus so much on performance. You've got to do these things, but even that may not be enough. But then Christopher Love writes a book on grace, which we've published, in which he says, basing it on 1 Kings 14:13, speaking of someone in the Old Testament, says, God found in him the one good thing. And he says, that's the new covenant. He says, there may only be one good thing that you've ever done in your life, and God finds that, and that's your life. And he refers to the people in Hebrews. Rahab a harlot. You know, and for most of those, as far as we know, that's the only thing they ever did right. And yet they're heroes of the faith. And so you have both of those in the same venue. But again, all of us have what I call grids or filters that we put everything through. So these men, and again, I'm not getting Freudian here. He was two centuries away from being born. But they were raised certain ways in certain cultures and such things as that. And we bring all of that with us. And yet they all coexisted quite well. And I think if you read and had a chance to talk to Matthew Mead, do you disagree with Christopher Love? He's absolutely not. See.
Well, let's use as an example Edwards again. If you look at Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and you read the text that he preached from.
Their feet shall slide in due time.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with the sermon.
He had a good sermon, he just needed a verse for it.
That sounds familiar.
It's been a pleasure to have you on the program, Don. I hope people will pick this up. Why read the Puritans today? You don't have to agree with everything that the Puritans said. You don't have to agree with everything. I'm sure you shouldn't agree with everything that we say, or everything that Reformed or Reformation Christians say, just because they're in a particular camp. As Don says, you know, we need to be very careful about everybody we read and everybody we listen to. But this will help, because you shouldn't shut yourself off to this great vein of Reformation thinking. These are the people, remember, who put together the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms. They are a great resource for us today, and hope you'll begin reading them carefully.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Don Kisser will be back with us next week. This is part one. He'll be with us next week for part two, as we're taking a look at the Puritans. This is Mike Horton and Ken Jones for The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.